Welcome to the History of Little Europe, Episode 1.8, The Four Houses of Switzerland. Last time, we left off with the death of Otto I and the establishment of the Holy Roman Empire. Today, I want to zoom out a bit and cover some ground between where we are now and the foundation of the Swiss Confederation, which is now on the horizon. The uprising ended up not going anywhere, and Henry was locked up, where he would spend the next 10 years, after which he would... Following the death of Otto I, he was succeeded by his son Otto II. As I mentioned in the last episode, Otto II enjoyed probably the most peaceful coronation in centuries. At the time of his father's death, he not only had no brothers or rivals to power, but had been serving as King of Germany for the past 12 years, while his father ran about in Italy and Hungary. So when he assumed power, the assumption among the nobles was not, "Do we really want this guy?" but instead, "How do we work with this guy to get more stuff?" Despite not having any real contenders to the throne, Otto II managed to make one anyway out of his cousin Henry II. The conflict between them is a mess, but basically, they each had different heirs in mind. Otto appointed his chosen heir to a preferred position, and Henry rebelled, end up inheriting the throne for himself. But I'm getting ahead of myself. As had happened after the death of Charlemagne, Otto I had conquered huge swaths of land, but he hadn't subjugated or stabilized many of these areas, so the responsibilities of that were left to his son. Chief among these was Italy, which remained stubbornly independent. So Otto decided to spend the remainder of his reign getting involved in Italian politics, which is an absolute mess considering the state of the peninsula. In the end, he managed to push the border of the empire slightly south, but nothing much of note happened. After that, he endured what history now calls the Great Slav Uprising, where the eastern tribes successfully threw off the mantle of Catholicism, perpetuating their paganism for another century, and taking Prussian lands out of the empire. The Danes also took this time to expand southward, claiming some Saxon territory for themselves. With all of this achieved, Otto II died. The line of imperial succession passed to his son, Otto III, who spent his entire reign focused on Italy, fighting battles and attempting to make Rome the capital of the empire. Reportedly, he was an extremely bright person, possessing great knowledge of both classical history and speaking three languages. He was apparently quite infatuated not only with the Eternal City, but also with the great empire that was once based out of it, and he spent much of his reign trying to remake his own court into a mirror of Roman practices. In short, he was the closest the HRE ever came to actually being what their name described them as. But Otto would die relatively soon into his reign, and most of his changes would be cast off by his successor. Otto III had not selected an heir and lacked a son, so Henry II, now out of imprisonment, decided to make a stab at the title. He managed to get himself named King of Germany, which forced everyone around him to recognize him as emperor, but it also transferred his capital back out of Italy, swiftly canceling all of Otto III's Roman-themed changes. He also only managed to secure the support of the nobles by giving them more power and autonomy, which further contributed to the decentralization of the empire. The rest of his reign is characterized by the campaigns in Poland, which were moderately successful, but Otto then enjoyed just enough stability to get involved in foreign politics for a while. After waging war against the Danes, who for the past century or so had been raiding coastal settlements, he managed to annex the kingdom, which would, of course, fall apart almost immediately afterwards. He then got involved in a conflict with France over Lorraine, which spiraled into a French army sacking his capital at Aachen, and then Otto turning around and besieging Paris, until the two kings decided to just end the whole thing. And I should point out that with France and the Holy Roman Empire now fighting over territory, the ties between the two have pretty much been fully severed. Having concluded these border conflicts, Otto II settled in to resolve some internal disputes. Two did little of major consequence to our story and died without an heir. The death of Henry II in 1024 officially ended the Ottonian dynasty, and instead a new successor was chosen. Looking back, the Ottonian dynasty is a very close replica of the Carolingian one. You had a figure of mild importance founding the dynasty, and a great leader following who carved out an empire. His descendants would then, over time, screw it up and lose both the momentum and often their own legitimacy. At least the empire is still technically in one piece, for now. The various princes of the empire gathered to vote for a new emperor, rather than wage wars for succession, which, although for now was just precedence, it would eventually become the standard for naming every emperor. The princes chose Conrad II, beginning what we know today as the Salian dynasty. Conrad would continue the tradition of focusing on Italy, where he would attempt to subjugate the rising city of Venice. He spent most of his reign campaigning on the various frontiers of the empire, which has very little importance to us, with one major exception. In 1032, a noble loyal to Conrad had been placed on the Burgundian throne, died, launching a fight between France and the HRE forces to claim the territory. For the French, this was an attempt at pushing back against a Germany that had been slowly pushing against them for the past century. For the Empire, Burgundy held key Alpine passes, which were critical for holding down Italy, the major focus of imperial ambition. Of course, these Alpine passes hold extra importance in our story, but this is to come. Over the next 2 years, the forces in the region campaigned against each other, but in the end, Conrad won out. Instead of placing a new emperor on the throne, however, Conrad decided to fully annex the kingdom into the empire, which formally stretched imperial boundaries around the entirety of modern Switzerland. Once again, we have all the pieces together. In fact, with all of the pieces together, we are, as of right now, dropping our focus away from anything other than Switzerland. I spent the past 6 episodes or so purposely covering history that extended beyond Switzerland so that in a future series, we would have a lot of the legwork already done. If or when I do a series on a Benelux country or another Central European nation, the material we'll have covered here will get us up to speed much more quickly. But as of right now, we're done with that. We're zooming in on Switzerland and leaving everyone else to their own devices. But we're not quite at the point of declaring the Swiss Confederacy. That particular event will be covered in the next episode. For now, we need to give a little bit more background on the area at this point in time. The Swiss Confederacy will be declared in 1291, and we are still floating somewhere around the 1100 mark, so we need to cover what goes on across that time period. And above all, that time period is characterized by 4 dynasties fighting amongst each other for regional control over Switzerland. Perhaps by pure coincidence, 2 of these dynasties, established as neighbors in Switzerland, would last to the World Wars and become massive entities in the history of Europe. But the 2 smaller dynasties lay more of the groundwork for the history of Switzerland, so we will start with them. The first of these houses was the Zähringen. This house traced its lineage through various minor nobles in southern Germany all the way to the Alemanni, one of the 3 tribes of Switzerland. The house was officially established in 1098 by Berthold II, who traded his title as Duke of Swabia for lands in Switzerland, around and including Zurich, as well as Zähringen Castle, which the dynasty is named for. From there, they slowly expanded in importance across the Swiss plateau, marrying, conquering, and inheriting their way into new land, and founding the cities of Freiburg and Bern. By 1200, though, their territory was on the decline, as other houses in the region grew in importance. At that point, they still encompassed the westernmost part of German Switzerland, a stretch of land in the Alps from Interlaken to Uri, and possessed control over Zurich, though the city was not linked to the rest of their territory, making them a key player in the region. The second minor dynasty was the Kyburgs. This household, also based in southwestern Germany, inherited several of the claims of the declining Zähringen household, with various tracts of land scattered throughout the country, but had a base of power in the northeast, where they stretched from just outside of Zurich to the city of St. Gallen. Of the 4, they are the least important and will be quickly conquered, but at 1200 they still controlled significant chunks of land. Now, the last 2 dynasties on our list are absolute behemoths in terms of European history. Especially in the late medieval period, where family dynamics and court intrigue decided the fate of nations, these 2 would be the main contenders, squabbling with each other across the entire continent, trying to lock down various titles for themselves. But even among them, one holds less importance. That is the House of Savoy. Also originally based in southern Germany, this line of nobles slowly took their territory southward, into the region between Italy and France today, but still controlled most of French Switzerland, stretching around almost all of Lake Geneva, though not including the city itself, including Lausanne, and stretching north to Neuchâtel. But while they would become a behemoth in their own right, their Swiss possessions would be on the decline as well, in the face of the biggest one of them all. In terms of historical importance, there are few families that hold the same earth-moving power across centuries, quite like the Habsburgs. The name itself is massive in European history, and at various times in their history, they held southern Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, even all of Spain. But the cornerstone of their power was their massive empire in Central Europe, from Austria to Ukraine, dominating the Balkans and acting as the greatest German kingdom for nearly 500 years, until the Prussians took that title away from them. But by some luck of history, this great house of Europe also finds itself laying foundations here, in Switzerland. Eventually, this dynasty would possess several kingdoms throughout the Mediterranean, culminating with the unification of Italy, where they would rule the nation through the First World War and until Mussolini assumed power. But the future kings of Italy got their start here, in the Alpine lands of Switzerland. The dynasty is of such importance that its founding is somewhat drawn from legend, but it is believed to have originated out of Habsburg Castle, about halfway between Zurich and Basel. Based out of this castle, the Habsburgs capitalized on the deaths of various nobles among the Zuringen and Kaiburgs to build a kingdom throughout Switzerland. This is also the birth of their reputation of amassing power through a game of nobles, marrying and inheriting their way into an empire. Their opportunistic plays here wedged a kingdom of their own between other Swiss powers, and while possessing none of the major cities in Switzerland, they were on a rapid increase in power, and would eventually edge out the three other houses. But perhaps most shocking of all is that even with these great dynasties based out of the area, with the Habsburgs quickly amassing territory that would catapult them into the greatest family of Europe, none of the four is the predecessor to the modern Swiss state. Instead, within these four squabbling powers was a small section of neutral territory high up in the Alps, a Switzerland within a Switzerland. Quite literally, in fact, because it included the canton for which the whole nation would be named. Possessing nothing more than cows, alpine villages, and a certain mountain pass that might make emperors interested in Italy willing to make concessions, this grouping of mountain cantons will, in the next episode, found the Swiss Confederacy, pushing out the great houses of Europe from their starting territories and lasting all the way until Napoleon. It may have taken us 8 episodes, but here we are at Switzerland. As always, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, declarations, manifestos, or affidavits, feel free to send them to historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com. Stay tuned, be sure to subscribe, and give the show a 5-star rating. Until then, pozdrav, ciao, and goodbye.